Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program.
Good evening, good to be with you. Sitting here in for John just this week, he'll be back next Sunday. But we hope this evening you'll have, a riveting program. In our first hour, we're going to do some discussion with some of the religious leaders and key people in religious bodies who are concerned with refugees. The topic is refugees, government policy, religious bodies, and walking the walk. There's been a lot of criticism of refugee asylum seeker policy from religious bodies of federal government policy, and we're hoping tonight to explore some solutions, some ways in which religious bodies might be able to offer to assist the federal government in dealing with our issues surrounding asylum seekers, migrants, refugees. Well, opinion is split, of course. Refugee issue is a bit of a nightmare for any federal government, I suppose. And there are even currently some groups which call for Christian refugees to be favoured. Fred Nile has gone on record saying that, and the Stand Up for Australia party has said, you know, we really should be thinking about the Christians who are in Egypt, the Copts, and we should be thinking about Christians in Iraq. Well, there's a sentiment there, I suppose, which one might understand when the speakers are Christians. But there is also such a thing as international justice, I suppose, and we live in a secular democracy where religious discrimination is pretty much against the law. Now, according to a media release sent out just a week ago, religious agencies are not just criticising, though, of course, and of course it's wrong to think that they are, because they offer all sorts of services to migrants and refugees. There are extensive networks of Christian agencies that assist refugees, Jewish agencies, Muslim agencies, secular agencies, there are all sorts of them going. So to get the idea that churches just criticise is wrong. And in this hour, we hope to talk a little bit about how churches might offer solutions. Now, we're fortunate enough to have on our panel tonight four people who have a fair few clues about these sorts of things. First up, I'd like to welcome into the studio Phil Glendenning, the director of the Edmund Rice Centre. Phil, good to have you here.
Yeah, I know.
In our Melbourne studio, we've got Pastor Dale Stevenson, who's the CEO of Crossway Baptist Church. It's a mega church, actually, in Melbourne, a very big church down there, who has come forth with a solution just a little while ago, which we'll talk about a little later in the program. Welcome to the program, Dale.
Yes, g'day, Noel.
Good to have you here.
Thank you.
In studio also with me here, David Claydon, an Anglican minister, a canon of Sydney Cathedral, a canon of Cairo Cathedral as well, with connections to the Arabic-speaking Christian community and knowledge of that area. And David chairs the National Heads of Churches Conference. It's called Dealing with Diversity. Now, that is a group which talks among the heads and leaders of churches with the minister. They don't advise, they talk. They chat about what they know and what's coming up through their various agencies. And also to give a bit of historical perspective on the migrant and refugee experience, Rabbi Jacqueline Ninio, who was from Emmanuel Synagogue in Sydney here. Rabbi Ninio was, in fact, I think, the first female rabbi appointed in your synagogue many years ago now, though.
That's right, 14 years ago, so I'm still there.
Long tenure, you must be enjoying it.
I'm loving it.
Phil, can I start with you? Your agency, the Edmund Rice Centre, it's involved in all sorts of, ways of assisting asylum seekers, refugees, promoting all sorts of stuff for the needy and the disadvantaged, but you have special interest in this area. Mm-hmm. Can you give us an idea of the sorts of things your organisation does? What do you offer?
Well, we offer a range of services to refugees and asylum seekers, ranging from English language classes through to casework management, through to assisting people with their legal cases. But also we have been involved very closely in providing research services to look at why people have come, what their background and their stories are, to try and put a human face on refugees, because part of the characteristic, if you like, in Australia in the past 15 to 20 years has been to lock people away nameless and faceless. And moreover, that led us then to investigate what happened to those who came to Australia seeking protection and who were sent away.
I read some of this report. You followed some pretty awful stories of people returned to places like Afghanistan.
Yeah, we've been to Afghanistan a number of occasions and Syria. We've actually been to 22 countries. We've tracked approximately 300 people to see what happens to them. Based upon the premise, Chris Sidoti, when he was the head of the Human Rights Commission here, said that unless and until Australia sees what happens to those we reject, we won't properly be able to determine if we are correctly assessing refugees.
What have you come up with?
Well, we found, tragically, that here in Afghanistan alone, we confirmed 11 people were killed. We believe that number's far higher, more like 22.
These were deemed by our authorities not to be in danger.
Yes, the vast majority of those came from Nauru. And I find it perplexing in this current debate with, in the wake of the decision of the High Court, that there are some politicians and some commentators are saying, well, the solution to all our problems is Nauru. And what they've conveniently forgotten is that when Nauru camp was open, we sent 42 unaccompanied minors back to Kabul in the middle of a war. We sent 50% of those on Nauru back. The rest of them who stayed ultimately got resettled in Australia anyway, and a number of those people were killed, including children. We think those lives count, and that those stories are not to be forgotten. And I find it quite bizarre, frankly, when this current debate, when people think Nauru was some solution, when Nauru was, frankly, a very poignant, elegant expression of the problem.
Well, there are, of course, many voices which criticise this whole idea of, you know, excluded migration zones, get them anywhere except the Australian Central Territory on an island anywhere. Well, it's almost like avoiding the problem, some people would criticise.
Well, look, you know, Brian Dawe, the magnificent satirist actor from Melbourne recently said, you know, we wouldn't need these policies if Australia just had a moat. You know, let's all close our eyes for a moment and imagine Australia was an island surrounded by water. Why would we do this? I mean, other countries don't do it. You know, and if you look at countries that have a serious problem with boat arrivals, you know, places like Greece, Italy, Spain, they don't do this. I was recently in Italy, and the Prime Minister Berlusconi is under all sorts of public pressure because he's not doing enough to assist the 50,000-plus boat people who are arriving in his country per month.
50,000 per month, per you're month. Saying? That's the magnitude?
Yes.
Compared to in Australia?
Well, you know, last year we were complaining about 6,000. We sat across the table in Malaysia recently talking about the fact that we've got 6,000 boat people in a very big year, when in Malaysia there's 96,800 refugees. And we said, let's just stop for a minute and imagine those 6,000 people in the MCG. Hmm. Now, if that number of people turned up for an Aussie Rules match, well,
we'd be worried about ticket sales, wouldn't we?
There would be an inquiry as to how come there were so few people in the ground. This is a confected problem, I put it to you.
It's very helpful, I think, to get the economies of scale, if you know what I mean, between Italy and those Mediterranean countries, which are getting large influxes of people from countries which are, well, in terrible strife. Rabbi Ninio, I'd like to talk historically all of a sudden, because we're talking here about particular situations in the present day. We've known about Afghanistan, we've known about Iraq, Sri Lanka, and that, of course, produces particular segments of people who want to move out of particular countries. But, of course, Jewish Australians have a very long history of migration and, in fact, refugees needing to come here, don't they?
Absolutely, and the face of the Jewish community in Australia was changed dramatically by the influx of refugees that came either before the war or post-war. But even still, the numbers were tiny compared with the number of people who needed shelter and needed refuge. And
in perspective, we were under White Australia policy effectively at the time, where we were selecting, you know, good Anglo-Saxon stock was what we were after, I think, until nearly 1970-something, I think, was what we were after. And leading up to the outbreak of the Second World War, it was becoming very, very clear what was happening within Europe to the Jewish people. And I think, just from my research, I think there were, 7,000 Jewish refugees allowed into Australia before the war, but it took the Holocaust for Australia to change its policy significantly enough to allow more significant numbers to come in after the war.
That's true, but my understanding is it was still only around 15,000 that came in, you know, in total. So it's a very small number of Jews who were able to come into the country, and they were under quotas. There were limits to the number of Jews who were allowed to come into Australia. There were the Jewish community worked very, very hard, created a number of organisations to lobby the government and to assist the Jewish refugees to come. There was at one point a minimum amount of money that they had to have, for example, to come to Australia. So the Jewish communities here and overseas raised money in order to be able to pay that passage for them to enter Australia, and then once they came, to do everything they could to help settle and absorb them into the community, because at one point, you know, the Jewish community said, we don't want the government to have to pay anything for these refugees to come, in the hope, I guess, that we would be able to bring more people in if they saw that we were going to have a positive influence on the society and not to be a drain on the public.
And nevertheless, there would have been voices raised against the idea of identifiably Jewish groups of people coming to Australia as opposed to Irish Catholics or good English Protestants.
Yeah, there were definitely incredible statements. You know, you read them now and I can't believe that, you know, they were said. But they said things like, you know, the Jews won't assimilate into society. They'll form their own groups. It will create a problem where we don't have one now of segregating society, and yet they were also quite willing to say that the Jews who were here already were wonderful, like they were good citizens and they were integrated.
They're nice because they've integrated already.
Right, but we don't want to bring any more in, you know, just in case we import a problem. And you know, these people were dying. It wasn't as if it was a you know, a minor thing that was going on for them. You know, their lives were at risk. It was. People knew what was happening.
Well,
and
it sounds familiar.
It does
right.
sound familiar, doesn't it?
Doesn't it?
It does sound familiar, which is precisely why I think it's very helpful to have the voice of the leader of a smaller faith community. Mm. We're talking about, you know, a minority faith community, Jews in Australia. But Islam is in the same position now. Muslims are in the same position. And we are in a state where there are many people who have misgivings about Muslims coming here. Now, given that I think a third of all Muslims in Australia are born here for a start, nevertheless, there are voices raised about the type of immigrant that's coming, because Afghanistan, of course, is largely Muslim, and therefore that's where those refugees... Iraq is going to be the same sort of position. And it strikes me that maybe drawing a long bow that, you know, 1946 people were saying, oh, you know, not sure about Jews, the ones over there, the ones who are here are okay.
Well, I think what Phil said before is crucial. I think that when we start to speak about large numbers of people and talking about the Jews or the Muslims, we can easily demonise people and make broad generalisations. And when you hear the stories of the individual people, that's when you really understand that these are human beings who are traumatised and fleeing for their lives. And every person has a story, and every person is just seeking something that I think many of us take for granted, you know, the chance to live in peace and in freedom.
Well, I hear the language of human rights, though, coming out of your mouth here. You see that implicit in what you've just said there is that the determination of whether somebody is a refugee deserving, you know, our help, the principal consideration is not whether they're a Jew or a Christian or a Muslim. That seems to be obvious, Phil.
It's whether they're a human being.
Well, this is where it comes down to. And it strikes me that those voices in Australia who are favouring, let's get the Christians out first, seem to be missing the main point of what it is that a refugee is.
Yeah, which is someone who's got a well-founded fear of persecution on the grounds of their ethnicity, their religion, their political opinion, belonging to a social group. But I think if you went back to the early 1800s, you would find these same things being said about the Irish.
Oh, you would?
You would say the same thing's been said about those the Chinese people when they first started to come. And yet we know, as you hear it now with regard to Afghans, we know for a fact that, you know, one of the kids from the Tampa and one of those children on Christmas Island at the moment will be playing fullback for the Rabbitohs within 10 years, and his sister will be studying medicine at Adelaide University, because that's what happens in Australia. Mm. The question is, you know, learning from the sins of that history so we don't continue to repeat them.
Now, just to put the other spoke on that wheel, though, of course, David, you have an experience and connection to Arab Christians. Mm-hmm. You do indeed. And when you hear those calls from certain Christian leaders saying we should be favouring Christian refugees, how do you react to that?
Well, I mean, obviously, one is concerned on any sort of discrimination. On the other hand, one's also aware that sometimes those statements are about people who are being persecuted and the need to help them. And at the moment, there isn't any particular infrastructure to help them. So that is the other side of the problem. If they're speaking about people are being persecuted, then that's an issue which needs to be related.
Persecution is the issue.
That's right. Mm. Yeah.
That's what it comes down to. Mm. Well, in our Melbourne studio, can I bring you into the conversation, please, Pastor Dale Stevenson? Because you've actually, we've just been talking generally, but you've actually offered a solution to unaccompanied minors in particular, haven't you? I've got the press release here dated the 22nd of August. Now, your large Baptist church has made looks like a pretty firm offer to me. Could you just explain to us what it is you're offering?
Yeah, certainly. Just before we go to the offer, it's worth just right-sizing the scale, as Phil was mentioning earlier, of our annual migrant intake. Asylum seekers represent 2% of our annual migrant intake, and then three-quarters of those arrive by plane. So those who are arriving by boat actually represent only 0.5% of our annual migrant intake. So that just helps us to right-size these desperate people's plight. The offer that we put to the federal government was for Crossway Baptist Church, in conjunction with Mission Australia and BaptCare. We put an offer forward for the unaccompanied minors that had just arrived. And so it was reported that on that boatload there were 13 unaccompanied minors. And at that point in time, the federal government's solution was going to be to send them back to Malaysia. And that just didn't sit well within me. I didn't feel like it was really the Australian way. And so we put an offer forward to the federal government to say, we'll take care of these children. We will, at no cost to the taxpayer, if you'll release them into our care, we'll bring the appropriate levels of professional standard and care. BaptCare does asylum work, and Mission Australia has a very broad resource, and Crossway has a very broad people base for that sort of social capital to come around the whole initiative. And so we put that out there into the marketplace just in an attempt both to advocate but also as a very real and solution-oriented, you know, offer.
So just to summarise that again, the point you've just made then is that a small percentage, 0.5%, who get imprisoned, effectively in mandatory detention and kept there for a long time, are those who have not arrived on a plane, they've come on a boat, they've come some other way, they're forcibly detained, and I think the most recent report I read was there were around 57 minors, underage people, who were in mandatory detention, and you're offering to take 13 of those.
So our initial offer was for those 13 children because we knew that was a scope that we could initially respond to. If the federal government is prepared to think in a different way, currently Tony Abbott is making an offer to Julia Gillard that they can cooperatively come up with an offshore plan still, that they could sort of work the legislation. And really, we'd be encouraging both sides of Parliament to think of, within Australia, a more integrated approach for those who come to our shores. Mm. And we don't have to think offshore. And certainly when it comes to the unaccompanied minors, we don't treat children like adults in a court of law. And yet when it comes to those in the most desperate of situation, so at best they're estranged, at worst they're orphaned, and we want to treat them like adults, and we do mandatory detention and the like, and there's just a better solution than that. There has to be. And so we thought we'd put forward a community-based solution.
So you're starting with unattached minors. That's I suspect that you might want to go further than that, but this is where your offer is at the moment. Phil, I saw you shaking your head then too.
Well, I think these sorts of offers are wonderful, and they're right across the sector. The community sector has, and church groups have come forward and have made this offer. Some of it is already happening. I think it's been a bad week for Minister Bowen, but one of the really good things that he has initiated this year is to move children and young families in particular out of detention, and that is happening.
There were a lot more at the beginning of the year, weren't there?
Absolutely. Well, and certainly it was announced at the beginning of the year. It took a while to take off, but it's beginning to move now, and the sky isn't falling.
And where do they go, though? Where have they been going at this point?
There's a whole range of community agencies. It's been facilitated by the department with the Red Cross and community groups, church groups who provide accommodation, provide support for not just unaccompanied minors, but for young families as well. And it, you know, it's a very important, effective way of bringing people into the community, which is basically what the rest of the world does.
Dale Stevenson, have you had any response to your offer yet?
Not from the federal government, no. There's been absolute silence. Oh, actually, that's maybe not an entirely fair comment. We took a call alerting us to the fact that the Prime Minister's department was having discussion about it, and but that they reaffirmed their current position. That was, of course, prior to the High Court ruling.
Can I say, it needs to happen a lot quicker than than it's been happening. But in the wake of the High Court ruling, it will have to happen. Because I think Mr. Abbott's made an offer to, you know, maybe look at offshore again. In this current political climate, that's going to be very difficult, particularly the view of the Solicitor General. If this goes up, if this does go forward, it will be legally challenged once more, and not a really good chance of getting up.
So are you effectively arguing for onshore solutions?
Absolutely. I think it's what the rest of the world does. It needs to be done humanely. I'm also arguing for for the regional process not to be walked away from. The head of the UNHCR here, Rick Toll, recently said that, you know, something in Southeast Asia that involves the region, the regional governments, some of those camps that the UNHCR has up there, to help process people more speedily, more effectively on the ground, to provide people with access to things other than just jumping in a boat or sitting on a queue for 28 years.
Dale, I want to come back to you just in a moment, but Rabbi Ninio, there was, after the war, an enormous number of Jewish children who were orphaned, who were separated from their families. And things like culturally appropriate care, I mean, respect for religion, respect for culture, were issues for the Jewish community back then.
Yes, there were, and there were a number of societies that were established in order to care for not just the children, but I think anyone who came from Europe at that time was incredibly broken. They had, most of them, lost all of their family. For many of them, they were the only person left. Whether they were an adult or a child, they were still suffering. And so the community did their absolute best to absorb them and to integrate them into the community, to find housing for them. And a number of the Jewish Welfare Association was established specifically to do that, but there were a number of organisations, B'nai B'rith, National Council of Jewish Women, and they all, you know, they would go and meet the boats, meet the people, bring them in.
Very practical, face-to-face
stuff.
Absolutely,
teaching English, helping people integrate into society, but also at that time healing, like helping them just to recover.
Get over the trauma, basically.
The trauma and the horrendous experiences. And for many of them, they were not able to come directly here. They'd spent a lot of time in, camps overseas, waiting to be able to come and, and processing and all those sorts of things. So by the time they actually arrived, it was still, pretty shattered and devastated people.
I acknowledge that in a sense we're skipping across different groups. Some were displaced persons who were processed overseas and came here. Others were refugees of the sort that we'd be talking about now. And I acknowledge that we are talking across that. But Dale, what we've just been speaking about with Rabbi Ninio there brings up the issue of culturally appropriate care. You're a mega church, 5,000 Baptists, and we're probably talking about 13... Afghan Muslims, maybe. I mean, it's not clear who they are, but how do you go about giving culturally appropriate care so that if mum and dad find them in 6 or 7 years' time, they don't discover that they've given their lives to Jesus, if you know what I mean.
Sure, know exactly what you mean. The best advice that we have for unaccompanied minors finding their way into an Australian society is initially for cluster housing. With
keeping
living,
them together, in other words.
That's right, with a live-in carer, in a small group, with a live-in carer, and then all sorts of intensive support services around them, particularly for the first 3 to 6 months, which would include trauma counselling, language skills. Obviously, they need people around them who can speak their language and then who can help them to begin to integrate into Australia. Once that initial intensive period is over, and this is where sort of a community response can kick in, their capacity may be in pairs to go and have a weekend with an appropriately vetted Australian family so they can have meals, they can begin to see and have a positive experience of Australians, and then a little further down the track, probably being placed into a foster care type situation and then into the broader educational system once they're once they're ready to take those big and brave steps as a young person coming to Australia.
And that's why you've teamed up with Baptistcare and Mission Australia, so those ancillary services are available to you, I presume.
Absolutely. So we recognise we are not experts in this field at all, but we do have both a people base and we do have a voice. And it just comes out of a conviction. You know, I was sitting there and I was hearing a lot of people saying that they were against, you know, what was happening, and people were against the mandatory detention, etc. And I was looking, where's some of the solution voices around this thing? And it didn't take long at all, really, to find partnerships and to put a community sector response forward as a genuine alternative to the federal government.
If you're plus 5,000 people, and it is a big church you've got there, I think you've done a miracle if you've managed to pull everybody on side in favour of this. Is that, have you got everybody agreeing with you?
No, that's not possible. these are people, but I think it's fair to say the weight of numbers is certainly supportive. I've had an enormous number of people, giving their support. There is a minority response, of course, who are concerned. People are concerned for all sorts of different reasons. Frequently, the issues they are concerned about aren't the real issues, but that's just the sort of thing you work with. That's part of helping to provide a lead.
Bill?
Look, I think the key thing in this whole area is, you just mentioned, Dale, is about partnerships. And within the Australian society, within the Australian community, there are some really fantastic organisations made up of refugees themselves. I know the Afghan community in Sydney, the Horn of Africa communities in Sydney and Melbourne in particular, have been doing some phenomenal things in helping young unaccompanied minors integrate into the community in partnership with church groups, community groups, and government department. And I think there are models there of real possibilities of being able to do this effectively. Just the other night, in response to the crisis in the Horn of Africa, the local community here in New South Wales pulled together and decided to tax each other domestically and managed to raise some $60,000 to be provided for the care of people on the Somali border. The idea being refugees felt they had an obligation to help people in the same situation that they were in once. It's an outstanding good news story, and done by the Horn of Africa Relief and Development Agency here in this city of Sydney. And right across the community, we've got examples of that, where people use their expertise, their experience, their history and their knowledge to care not only just for the young, but also for those who are facing similar difficulties to the ones that they have faced.
It strikes me also that it's about speed, isn't it, too? This question is, I remember, I'm in the odd position of, I think, around the year 2001, being on a... I was with an ABC crew in the centre of Australia, travelling with heads of churches when the Woomera Detention Centre fell apart. Yeah. And we were actually inside it as the wall was coming down. And just beforehand, we saw the state of it. And it was, I have to say, Rabbi Ninio, it struck me that the only other time I'd seen anything like the scene I saw was in the photos of troops coming into the concentration camps, of just hundreds of people standing looking out across wire fences in the middle of nowhere.
Well, actually, concentration camp is a good word, because a concentration camp is where you put people not because of anything that they have done, but because of who they are. Now, you hear often in the popular debate about asylum seekers being, illegal. Well, we know that's not true, because they're not charged with any offence. They haven't broken any law. And yet the greatest sanction we have as a society is the withdrawal of someone's liberty. Now, even if you're in Long Bay Jail tonight or Pentridge, you've got a fair idea of when you're going to get out. But for too long in this country, people would be locked up and would not have any idea of when they may be released. Now, that's just cruel. It doesn't work. It costs the taxpayer $772 million a year. It's cost $1 billion since 2001 to run the offshore processing system. We can use our resources more effectively and without being cruel.
Dale, how hopeful are you that your offer could be taken up? Because I'm hearing, it doesn't seem that these things move quickly.
They haven't moved quickly, and they need to move more quickly.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Since the High Court decision, the government has a crisis on its hands. It needs to figure out what it's going to do. I'm genuinely disappointed that Tony Abbott is still thinking offshore, that the sort of collaborative efforts at a federal government level is still thinking in that direction. And I think no small part of the challenge is actually an educational challenge for our Australian population, that these people do not represent a threat to our nation. Mm. And just right-sizing the whole thing, as I've spoken to people, said, do you realise that those who arrive by boat represent a half a percent, a half of 1% of our annual migrant intake? Or even if you compare us to, say, the Nordic countries of Denmark, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Iceland, their collective population is about 25 million, not dissimilar to Australia. They take in over 51,000 asylum seekers annually, and we're taking in 6,500. And just right-sizing some of the scale. And I've had people say to me, really? Is that all it is? You know, is that what all of the hysteria is about? And so just realising these are real people. They're coming out of genuinely difficult situations. Australia is a signatory to the Refugee Convention, and hence the High Court decision saying, you know, that Australia is not honouring that if we're going to just attempt to offshore this problem. So you know, we just need to right-size the scope of the whole scenario. And I feel like as a nation, we need to take a deep breath. We need to take a fresh look at what the actual situation is. And if there's a little bit more political will, a little bit more political courage to actually address it at that level, we might even find that our broader Australian population breathes a sigh of relief and says, is that all it is? Well, certainly, we can do something about that as a nation. And we're the only Western democracy that has mandatory detention in that sort of open sense. And other countries are processing people in 30 days, children in 2 weeks. And
I think our department says 90 days is what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I think we need to move to 30 days, and we need to, if we have it at all, it needs to be limited to 30 days for health, security and identity checks. This is what the Refugee Council of Australia's position is. And after that, if that needs to be extended, then that needs the permission of a court. That this notion of just locking people up forever is crazy.
Without appeal to law.
Without appeal to law is crazy. I mean, look, we putting together our offshore-onshore quota, every year we take about 14,000 all up. You know, you compare that with, and we've got about maybe 22,000 people in refugee-like situations. You compare that to Pakistan with 1.7 million people, you know. Mm. We don't have a problem here. We really don't. And if you think about all the good things refugees have done for the country anyway, you know, what pearls we can be throwing into the ocean often.
You're on ABC Local Radio around Australia. My guest tonight, Pastor Dale Stevenson, who's the CEO of Crossway Baptist Megachurch in Melbourne, David Claydon, Canon of Sydney Cathedral and Cairo Cathedral, Rabbi Jacqueline Ninio, Rabbi from Emmanuel Synagogue, and Phil Glendenning, the Director of Edmund Rice Centre. You may have a question or a comment for any or all of our panellists tonight. 1-300-800-222 is the number. 1-300-800-222 if you do have a question. Phil, given that you've been monitoring the safety of rejected asylum seekers, and we're talking about speeding up the process, how are you confident that speeding it up to 30 days is going to end up in results that are...
Oh, no, I think health, security and identity checks, not for final determination of a person's claim. We're saying while people are having their claims assessed, they can live quite comfortably in the community.
So released into the community, monitored in the community.
Yes, that's right. And in the way that it's done in Britain and the United States and Canada and very similar democracies to ours. And, you know, the statistics indicate in those other jurisdictions that people don't abscond because they have a vested interest in staying
in trying to get through the process.
Positive outcome, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I guess the other thing that worries me about this whole Nauru exercise, having been there just recently, you know, it's a terribly, terribly poor country. Where we should need to be doing more to help with the development of the place without, you know, hanging a carrot out for them to perform a trick in order for them to...
Outsourcing our problem by offering the money and...
You know, the water was off between 9 and 5 in Nauru. The topside camp that you hear Mr. Rabbit and Mr. Morrison talking about virtually doesn't exist. There's only two buildings left standing, and the bottom camp is now a fully functioning primary school. And it's interesting that when they went there on the weekend. when the school wasn't there. So, you know, we're going to kick the kids out of there.
Not an ideal situation, having seen it yourself, in
it's
other
not,
words.
Look, it's not going to... It can't work, it should not work, it should never have been started.
Canon David Hayden, sorry I haven't come to you sooner, but an interesting thing you told me was the way in which church bodies can participate in these processes is not as I expected it, because, in fact, Anglicare has been knocked out of this process because it failed by tender. Is that... That's what you told me.
Yes, that's now the way it works. That there has to be a tendering process. The trouble with a tendering process is, of course, it's all dependent on dollars. And so it all depends on the fact of who's going to under-tender for dollars, and then that organisation that has, in fact, under-tendered, not only Anglicare but many of the other church groups, actually only gives 1 hour to any refugee that arrives in the country that's in a temporary visa or whatever arrangement.
These are not big organisations like Anglicare would be or Mission Australia.
No, it's a very small organisation. Very small. And they're not caring for the people. They give 1 hour because that's the way they tendered for 1 hour's worth. Mm. It's a money thing. And they do whatever they do in 1 hour and that bang, that's the end. Whereas if the churches were allowed to handle it, then of course they work with volunteers. They're willing to work whatever period of time until a refugee and the family, if there is a family, thoroughly settled in. But settling in isn't just a matter of a house. It's a matter of filling the fridge with food. It's a matter of making sure they've got whatever they need in their house. But then taking them to the shops, taking them through the marketplace, you know, particularly, say, Coles or Woolworths.
Or say a refugee from Sudan or Kenya who's not used to...
It's such a totally, completely different culture. Anyway. It's overwhelming, really. And unless somebody spends that sort of time, it's hopeless. And we've actually raised this with the government, that dollars oughtn't to be the basis. There ought to be a different basis, which is based on time effect, based on the ability of the, in this case, the churches or other agencies to actually do things with people.
Well, how is it assessed, though? I mean, how do you decide whether an agency is delivering good quality care for refugees and asylum seekers?
Indeed. Well, it needs evaluation. And, of course, that's part of our issue, that I don't think the appropriate ministry has got the resources to do the evaluation.
They need more resources.
They need more resources and they need people with the right skills.
And if we weren't involved with spending so much money on mandatory detention, more resources would be available for that purpose. And there have been some horrific stories that, as a result of that tendering process. Yeah. Quite horrific. Well documented in Newcastle in particular. Yeah. That's actually resulted in you know, young children dying because of the inappropriate care being provided. And it's a direct result of that sort of competitive undercutting.
Mm. Where it's driven by price, as it were,
yep.
And look, rather than quality indicators.
That is right.
And the amount of... Imagine if we could apply the $772 million that our immigration detention network spent last year, we could apply that funding into providing appropriate community care for people.
Well, a lot of the argument is about this, isn't it? You hear the objection coming from some taxpayers that, you know, money is being spent on refugees who came here illegally, queue jumped. You hear these arguments made. Dale, are you asking the government for funding for what you're doing? How are you approaching it? It always comes down to money, doesn't it, really?
No, we're actually not asking for money in this process. We put an offer forward to the government saying we will take care of these 13 children. We'll seek to bring the best professional standards around the process. And what we were hoping to achieve by doing that, because I've had some people, you know, say to me, but that's only 13, and currently there's only 54 children or whatever it is, but it just helps to demonstrate there's an alternative model. And what Phil was saying before with regards to appropriate use of monies, I had one person who's in this field say it costs about 1/6 the amount to integrate a family or an individual into the community as compared to hold them in detention. So, you know, there's a much better way, a much bigger bang for the buck. And if we're only concerned about the dollar, we're concerned about much more than that, of course, but if we're only concerned about the dollar, we wouldn't hold people in mandatory detention. It's a terrible waste of money.
The economic argument doesn't stand up, you're saying.
Oh, it definitely
doesn't.
Give
them to the churches, they'll pay for them.
Where is an economic rationalist when we need one?
Yeah, really.
Rabbi Ninio, I think you wanted to...
I also think that there are a lot of people in Australian society who are wanting and willing to help, to reach out and to do things and to, like you said, both said, volunteer their time. I mean, I know that's in our community, we asked, we're doing some work with the Asylum Seeker Centre, and we asked for volunteers to come and help. And we had an overwhelming number of people who said, yes, we want to do something and we want to, you know, assist in any way we can.
There are a lot of people who are moved by the issue.
I think, yeah, that's right. And I'm sure it's not, you know, my community is not alone. We're not alone. Like, there are a lot of people who have had that refugee experience, like you were talking about before, Phil, and, you know, want to help. But even those who haven't, people who just see the traumatized people and want to reach out and do something. And this is an opportunity then for them to do that.
It's somehow a nexus, though, between a government policy funding, Department of Immigration, churches, organisations like Mission Australia and Anglicare, somehow getting that all connected together. And Canon Hayden, an organisation like Anglicare, and Sydney Anglicare effectively covers New South Wales because it comes out of the central diocese, doesn't it? If it's knocked out of the process, it, like, you know, the Edmund Rice Centre or the St Vincent de Paul Society or Mission Australia, it has all sorts of ancillary services which are not being used.
That's the problem. And there are so many different things. And it's already been mentioned with ESL or with a follow-up, particularly of the education of children, which need special care in many cases. All of these services are potentially available at no cost to the government. But it's just that the government doesn't have a mechanism other than the dollar sign.
But I think that's also where the partnerships are very effective. If you, you know, if the government aren't prepared to come to the party, which is a pity, and they should, but also for organisations to go directly to community organisations and see if we can form a bilateral partnership that way. But yeah, the process is not not as wonderful as it should be.
We should try and take a few calls. There's quite a few people on the line who'd like to make a comment or ask a question. I think we're going to try and speak to Peter in Exmouth. Peter, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Peter, what would you like to say or ask?
My comment is that yes, I feel for the people coming into Australia and the way that they're coming in, but what I've noticed is that they aren't integrating into the Australian way of life.
This is an important issue, of course, for a number of people. Yeah,
and I think that this is the main concern, that why the Australian people aren't concerned for the people coming in, because is they're not integrating into the Australian way of life. They want to wear their own dress, they want to have their own education, they want to have their own religion, which is fair enough. But if they're coming into Australia and the Australian taxpayer is paying their way, I think that the people that I...
You're saying there's a sort of a bargain that has to be returned, that if we're going to give you a hand to settle and integrate, then...
It has to be returned, but, I think that they've got to come to the Australian way of life.
Phil?
I think there's a historical reality we've got to consider here, and speaking as an Irish Catholic, I think the same things were said about Irish Catholics that came to this country in the 1800s about, not integrating, bringing their own religion, wanting to run their own schools. But I think if you look at
now they've taken over.
But if we study that and we look at it, with each generation that comes, certainly the initial integration is terribly difficult for people who've come from different cultures. But as I said before, within 5 or 10 years, particularly 10 years, we know that those young children, the next generation, will be playing full forward for Collingwood. The daughter will be studying medicine at Melbourne University, playing sport for the Hockey Roos. That's what happens. It won't happen instantly, of course not. But the richness that
people will
bring in that integration, I think, is something we've also got to bear in mind. And, a bit of patience doesn't go astray.
This also doesn't take into account that the migrants aren't exclusively Muslims.
Of course not.
So we've got people coming from all sorts of different circumstances. Right. So I understand the sentiment behind the argument.
I'm not sure that Peter was, in fact, saying Muslims. I think that he was just included in general. The cultural stuff here. That's right, Peter. Are you there?
I'm also looking at what's just happened in the UK, and I think a lot
of the civil unrest you're talking about.
Worried about that.
Well, look. Thank you very much, Peter. Thanks for calling. Thank you for raising those issues. I think they're on some people's minds, and it's worth having that, put right out there. Could we try John in Sydney? You there, John?
Noel, how are you?
Good. What would you like to say?
Look, I really would. I feel compelled to really compliment you and your program and your guests.
It's the guests. I'm just facilitating, but thank you.
Well, no, but look, it's not only compassionate and sane and decent, but it really is good to hear some of the most important facts And some facts are fairly clear-cut. I mean, I know that's a difficult term these days, but, you know, there is a difference between giving accurate information and giving either inaccurate misinformation or even just neglecting or omitting to talk about things. And tonight, you and your guests, particularly your guests, have just put some really important facts into context about the relativities and the numbers. You would think that we had a Spanish... trying to think of the word when you have a fleet of ships.
Armada.
Armada,
thank you very much, approaching our shores from...
I thought you were going to say auto de fe there, but there you go. Armada's better, isn't it? Go on.
But look, it's a bit of a strange term. But you would think we were about to be under attack. And as one of your guests said, you know, when he gave the specific numbers, I've listened to a lot of discussion about this, usually on quality media, usually my favourite ABC. Well, it is more reliable.
Three cheers for the left. Go on.
Well, it's not a matter of being left. I'm talking about if I listen to the other commercial stations, which I occasionally force myself to do, it is so much like propaganda. It is unbelievable. It is deliberately distorted. There's no doubt about that. But even on the ABC, you hardly ever hear the elephant in the room. And I think that in every second discussion about this, the facts should be put up about the percentages involved. It is infinitesimal. Yeah. And I'd like to link it to one other thing. First of all, I think that your guess, the approach, is terrific. It just might, you know, have some chance of people in a corner cracking it, but it seems like they've put each other and themselves into a corner. I'm fearful that this is so much a political thing being used for other reasons. It's a red herring. It's a scapegoat sort of thing to stir up all sorts of political stuff to win points. But it is a very humane approach, and at least you might get somewhere with it where nothing else. It's the least frustrating discussion I've heard.
John, look, thank you very much. We're going to have to leave it there because we're going to run out of time. But thank you very much for joining us. There is an issue there which we've not raised, and David, I know that you know a lot about this, and that the other elephant in the room, which is about, you know, the perception among some people that Islam is hijacking the immigration system, you know, the idea that somehow that's all we're taking, you know. How do you respond to people who have that fear?
Well, to some extent, there can be grounds for justification. If I was relating to some of the large church communities in the Middle East, they would actually support that position because they can actually quote who the immigration officers are and that there is a discrimination process actually going on, even though there shouldn't be.
Well, you've told me in some of these countries the immigration officers say, yes, if you're a Christian comes out and being persecuted, they say, no, there's no persecution,
right,
of Christians here.
Yeah.
So it seems to so work in their offices, though, where they become an
arm
of
officers,
government.
You yeah. see, it's sort of discrimination in reverse, really.
So it's not actually our end of it, it's
no,
the other
it's
end
the
of
other end of it, which yeah. is the problem.
Yeah. That's the view of the of many local governments, too, who are actually doing the persecuting.
Well, look, I would love to continue on this. We've got 10 seconds, Phil. 15.
We've got to get back to a common sense debate in the country. You know, compassion for people is not weakness. It's one of Australia's great fundamental traits to look after your mates, to give people a fair go. Compassion's not weakness. We can do this.
Look, I would like to give you all a last word, but I really have to say thank you and goodbye because we've got 30 seconds to go. Pastor Dale Stevenson in Melbourne, thank you for telling us about your offer.
Thank you very much, Noel.
I hope they pick you up on it. Phil Glendenning of the Edmund Rice Centre, thank you very much for giving us a lot of facts and background to that.
Thanks, mate.
Canon David Hayden, thank you very much. Clayton, sorry, beg your pardon. Thank you very much. And Rabbi Jacqueline Ninio, thank you all for being part of Sunday Nights.
Good.
This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.